Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part 2 of our discussion of the invention of board games. Now, in the last episode, we talked a lot about the idea of what play is and what games are and how they emerge from our biology. And the fact that this is still an open question, we talked about a lot of the evidence and the theories about why play exists in animals, what purpose it serves, if it might be biologically adaptive in one way or another, the idea of that maybe it trains us for future skills, that maybe it signals fitness, that maybe it makes us more versatile and able to deal with unexpected events, and all kinds of things like that. We also talked about theories about why abstracted versions of play like board games emerged, that maybe it was in order to sublimate a competitive instinct that could be violent if not given an outlet like games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't punch each other in the face. Play little Rock'em Sock'em Robots instead.
And then also the idea that there is a deep inherent link between board games, the earliest known board games, and the practice of divination or sortilege, where you might do things like cast lots to figure out the will of the gods or answer a question by consulting some type of pseudo-random object or event. You know, you throw knuckle bones and see what the gods are telling you, or consult the I Ching. Mm-hmm. And that these kinds of things could have given way to board games that also involve casting of lots or rolling of knuckle bones to see how many spaces you get to move on a board.
Right. And we see that legacy continue in modern games. Mystery Date, the Game of Life that we already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And though this is not technically a game, it is still kind of lumped into the same similar category, certainly something you can buy at a toy store. But the Magic 8 Ball. The Magic 8 Ball is a toy that is obviously just overtly a divination tool, mm-hmm. but one that I would say that even as a kid when I used a Magic 8 Ball, there was a sense of wanting it to be real. Like there was you leaned into the magic, into the sort of the divine aspect of the practice, even though you knew that this was not actually a hotline to the fates, or that God had anything to do with what was happening in the ball.
Oh, wait, Robert, do you hear that?
Yeah. What is that? Something kind of cutting in.
Cuddle cat, cuddle fish, to the second oil age.
And his kingdom was full of darkness.
I don't dispute the Eros data, but if he's down here, we'd know.
Not blood, but darkness. The Earth's black riches. No. I could taste it on my lips.
Today, I want to talk to you about the science of transgenesis.
Transgenesis.show.
Oh, I guess it's gone now. Maybe it wasn't anything.
Yeah. I just heard like a high-pitched, glitchy noise.
Oh, Robert, you got a bit of blood in the corner of your eye.
Oh, my goodness. I'm bleeding from around my eye. Let me get cleaned up here and we can keep going. I'm good.
Well, if I can get off topic for just a second here.
Oh, of course.
I do think that there actually is – that the eight ball and other divination methods like the Ouija board and all that
mm-hmm. –
you know, we can laugh at like the strict religious authorities and adults who say, don't fool around with the Ouija board, you know, mm-hmm. you're inviting demons in. Or they might say the same thing about the magic eight ball. On one hand, that's kind of funny. But on the other hand, of course, I'm not suggesting like real spiritual demons actually come in and possess you if you play with a Ouija board. I do think playing with a Ouija board can be kind of dangerous because it suggests a divinatory frame of mind, even if you don't go in believing in it. I mm-hmm. bet you've had this experience of playing around with something like this, not believing it has any real magical power. But then once you've played the game, you kind of start to wonder, and it tempts you. It tempts you to think in terms of fate, in terms of like the intervention of otherworldly forces in your life. If you play with it enough, I can see how it could really suck your mind into that cast of thinking, which can be harmful.
Well, even just marginal exposure to something to that kind of thinking can have an effect. I think back to the episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind we did on the Chinese zodiac
mm-hmm.
and the lunar calendar, the different zodiac animals associated with each year, and the sort of the loose to complicated characteristics that are aligned with individuals born in each year,
mm-hmm.
and how when you look at the birth statistics, you see this bump during years of the dragon, the most auspicious year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we found is that you didn't see this occurring because necessarily people were just like hardcore Chinese astrology believers, but there were other things, probably more important things, impacting their choices. But then this thing was in the background, like mm-hmm. a casual understanding of the zodiac, and then that ended up, perhaps the argument is, influencing their choices. So just having something like the eight ball or the Ouija board or astrology or whatever supernatural model you want to lean on, just having it there in the background can conceivably be enough to tweak your choices.
You know, and I wonder if this can be extended into partially explaining why games of chance have sometimes historically, and even sometimes by a few people today, been considered dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is this kind of danger, you know, even if there aren't really spirits that are going to come mess with you, there is a kind of danger in setting your mind to the cast of thinking that is encouraged by divination methods, and that rolling dice to play a game of chance is in a way a form of divination. It is kind of a slightly abstracted sortilege practice.
Now, I also want to remind everybody, since it may have been a week since you listened to the last episode, we're going to talk a little bit as we continue about sort of the what I'm thinking of are the three corners of gaming.
Okay.
That you're going to have the mechanics of the game. That's the rules, the system of rules that dictate how it's played.
The skeleton.
The skeleton, yeah. Who wins, how they win, et cetera. Then you have the fluff, which especially in modern games, this is the story, the characters, the setting, the flair.
Illustrations.
Yeah, the illustrations. And then you have the material aspect of it, which could be as simple as a board and some sort of a dice. Or it is something more elaborate, like it requires a pop-o-matic bubble, or the battleship set requires this whole plastic interface, et cetera.
The Omega virus robot
yes.
that talks to you, and
yeah.
or the videotape you put in with the one who is moving now.
Right. Or there are a lot of games nowadays. There are a lot of games that have just required timers. You need that hourglass, right? But a lot of games now that either have a timing element or something more complicated than that will require you to use an app. Which it can also be used to great effect.
Well, I think we should then try to turn our attention to what is the earliest known evidence of physical apparatus for these types of abstract games like board games. What's the earliest evidence we have that somebody was playing something like a board game?
Well, when you start diving back through history, you find that some of the what is considered the earliest archaeological evidence for board games pops up in the Neolithic Middle East around 7,000 BCE.
Wow, board games 9,000 years ago.
Yeah, but this would have been the time in which individuals living in this region were beginning to find social leisure and security on a regular basis for the first time.
Hmm.
So they were feeling safe enough, they were feeling secure enough in, you know, how much food they had available that they had, say, you know, a few minutes in the afternoon to scratch some a grid into the dirt and maybe move a few pebbles around.
Now, I would think a grid scratched into the dirt would not survive 9,000 years. So what is the physical evidence we have that people were playing games like this at the time?
Well, that is one of the key challenges, because we tend to find what might be the board or the pieces. And sometimes it can be difficult to figure out exactly what we're looking at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, if it's something as simple as pegs in stones or little holes drilled in stones or some sort of a grid in stones, there's a fair amount of interpretation figuring out why people made these marks.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we're not going to find anything like the rules for ancient game. If you have a game that is predating written language, there is no rule book to go by. It would have just been an oral tradition. So it's not always easy to say, yes, this was probably part of a game. This was something that served little or no purpose outside of leisure. For instance, there's the Neolithic Beta site, which dates back to somewhere between 7200 and 6500 BCE, and it's near Petra, Jordan. This is one of many ancient sites where we find stone slabs with three parallel rows of regular holes. And this might have been an early precursor to Mancala.
Ah, okay.
Which is, of course, one of the world's most ancient games and one that we still find versions of throughout the world. You can usually buy it at a store even.
I remember a version of Mancala got popular at my school, I think, when I was in – I don't know, something like sixth grade. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
I think it has comebacks occasionally.
Yeah. It's one of these you just see. I don't think I've ever owned a copy, but you see it around. Like for something with such ancient origins, it's still very much alive.
Basically, it involves like you get to go along a series of holes or impressions, dropping in seeds or stones one at a time and like counting out the number of places you get to go.
Right. It's generally colored beads nowadays, but the older model would have probably used seeds or beans. And this might reveal its origins as a fertility ritual for early agricultural societies.
Mm.
Again, getting a little bit into the divination, a little bit into the magical, perhaps, origins of games.
That's really interesting, the idea. Yeah, so seeds, agriculture, and fertility, but also having perhaps some kind of divinatory role.
Exactly, yeah. And these were pretty widespread to the point that Mancala games are even a whole category of ancient games in some classifications. Now, there are different classifications for games and board games that you'll find depending on who the scholar is that's doing the analysis. But for instance, Harold James Ruthren Murray is one of the individuals who categorized games. And he said, okay, well, we have Mancala games. That's a category. But then he had other games, for instance, alignment and configuration games. The most obvious example of this is tic-tac-toe.
Connect Four?
Connect Four, I think, would probably count. Basic principles the same. You have war games. Of course, the classic example there is chess, but you can throw in your Warhammer games. You can throw in your Risk games. I mean, these are all essentially games that simulate warfare. Then there are hunting games. I don't think I've played one of these, or at least I don't think I have, but Fox and Geese is an example that pops up in different cultures.
This was the hardest category for me to understand. I think maybe it involves sort of like collecting pieces, like you compete to collect them or something.
Yeah, it kind of makes more sense if you look at a picture of it. So if you do a search for Fox and Geese games, you'll see some images. Then there are race games, and the prime example here is backgammon.
I don't think I've ever played backgammon, so I don't actually know how you do it.
Well, it's a pretty ancient game but is also apparently a descendant of the two-row Roman dice game 12 Lines, which itself was based on older forms of the same mechanic.
Yeah,
and this is something you see with a lot of these games. It's just this continual evolution of form. Games are passed on almost virally from culture to culture, and new spins are put on them. Because to a certain extent, especially when it's just oral tradition – You know, it's like a game of telephone, but with the game rules, mm-hmm. Levels of complexity and simplification altering across the centuries.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key insights of the study of games is that games are not fixed. They always change.
Yeah, like even something like Monopoly, which we'll get into more later, but it's easy for me especially to think, okay, Monopoly is this awful game that never changes.
Oh yeah, we learned that last time. You hate Monopoly.
I hate Monopoly. Yeah, then you go to the store and there's some new version of Monopoly, and it's the same version of Monopoly, just with different pictures. Yeah. They just tweak the fluff. Uh-huh. Like you can even get Warhammer 40,000 Monopoly.
Star Wars Monopoly.
Yeah. But I say that, but I was
Deuce just, Bigelow Monopoly.
I say this, but I was just talking to Scott Benjamin, who helped us research this episode, and he pointed out that actually you do see evolution in Monopoly. There's a millennial Monopoly that came out where they've altered the rules, not only the fluff, but the rules itself to indicate that you're not buying things, you're renting things.
Hmm.
And then, of course, there's also like a card game based on Monopoly. There are other games with the same franchise and similar fluff.
Wait a minute. If you're renting them, what are your sublease when people land on your tiles on the board?
I don't know.
Community chest is replaced with like a take a puff at the jewel.
Well, as long as the game ends the same way all Monopoly games end, and that is with friends mad at each other, that's all that counts.
That's not my experience. That's my experience with Risk, is that Risk makes people hate each other.
Okay. I never played Risk. I had friends who were really into it. But yeah. That's one that also goes really long, right?
It can. And Risk is like the number one offender for outing table flippers, for letting you know which of your friends is actually a really bad sport. You find out through Risk.
Yeah. Thinking back to Monopoly, and then I think, I had friends who were playing Risk too, is that part of it is like a really long game that's played at night in many cases. And mm-hmm. So you've just been doing it for so long. Mm-hmm. You're tired. You need to go home. You need to go to sleep. But you're still stuck in this low stakes BS. And then, eventually you just got to flip the table.
Well, elements make it worse. Most often I'd say played for a long time at night by adult men who've maybe been consuming alcohol.
It's a bad scene. It'll let the demons in for sure. All right. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to roll into some more specific examples of ancient games. And really, we can learn a lot about just the nature of board games in general by looking at what we know and what we don't know about these ancient pastimes.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. Now, earlier we talked about the idea that there is perhaps physical evidence of some type of unidentified Neolithic board game that's been found in like near Petra in Jordan that was perhaps a form of the Moncala game type, but we don't know for sure, and that was maybe like 7,000 BCE or 9,000 years ago. The oldest game that we definitely really know about and are sure it's a game we have direct archaeological evidence of is a game from ancient Egypt called Senet.
That's right. Also known as the Game of 30 Squares.
Also known as the Game of Passing, which we'll get back to later. I think that's what Senet actually means, is passing.
So the dates range on this. So I've seen dates that say Senet goes back to roughly 3,000 BCE.
Yeah, I've seen that there's evidence traced to 3,500 BCE, or basically roughly the fourth millennium BCE.
Either way, it was played in pre-dynastic times, and we can even turn to tomb paintings that actually depict ancient Egyptians playing this game during this time period.
Yeah, one famous one is an ancient Egyptian painting of Queen Nefertari, one of the wives of Ramses the Great. And this painting of Nefertari playing Senet is within the queen's own tomb. So in her tomb, in the Valley of Queens in Thebes, there's a painting of her playing a board game. That's
right.
Dedication. I mean, she was probably nationally ranked.
Well, yeah, probably so. Now, when you look at this illustration, I've actually seen this illustration wrongfully identified as her playing chess.
Hmm.
That's not correct. Chess wouldn't come about for another 4,000 years in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's worth remembering, too. By the time chess was invented, games like this were more ancient than chess is now.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I love putting ancient history in that kind of perspective, like thinking about the things in ancient Egypt that were older to the ancient Romans than ancient Rome is to us.
Exactly.
That's always something I like to keep in perspective. So what do we know about this game, Senet? We know it was played with multiple game pieces. So there were these things that look kind of like pawns that were sometimes made of like a blue type ceramic material. And it was played on a grid of 30 squares. There were three rows of 10 squares. And several of the squares had symbolic hieroglyphs on them, seemingly symbolizing game imagery such as the water trap, like there'd be a water square. And while our evidence of Synod is often in the form of elaborate game boxes used by the wealthy, it's speculated that the game could also have been played by the poor simply by drawing a grid in the sand or by, like, making scratches on a rock or a board.
And this is something we see with some of the later games we're going to discuss, where you had the ornate version with a little, you know, it's a box underneath it to keep the pieces in. Mm-hmm. But then you also see evidence of graffiti versions where someone just scrawled it on stone and played it.
Exactly.
Now, the exact rules for Synod, though, are ultimately just a matter of conjecture.
Yeah, we know some things sort of, but we don't fully know how the game was originally played.
Right. And you can just imagine this exercise taking various modern games and imagining, you know, opening them and having absolutely no instructions, no written language about how they were played. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you can pretty much piece it together. Fireball Island, Candyland especially, Snakes and Ladders or Chutes and Ladders. These are games that, you know, you can figure it out pretty quickly. Other games with more, ambiguity, harder to tell, right? If you took a box of Arkham Horror, mm-hmm. it's hard enough to tell what you're supposed to do in Arkham Horror when you have the rules. But if you have no rules, I can imagine there would be different models based on, well, we think it was played this way. We think these tiles were possibly used in this way, shape, or form.
Future archaeologists 5,000 years from now are definitely going to be able to figure out how to play Crossfire because that's just obvious. You can't miss it.
Yeah. Hungry, hungry hippos. Yeah. That's another one.
Though, of course, you can determine some things, as we were saying, just by looking at what we've been talking about as the materials of the game are. What are the things you have to work with? It's believed that this game, Synod, was played by casting of some equivalent of dice, maybe casting knuckle bones or throwing sticks, and this would help determine what kind of moves you could make.
Knuckle bones, by the way, often these would be knuckle bones from, say, a sheep or a goat, so mm-hmm. something that was, you know, regularly slaughtered and used for to manufacture items. Mm-hmm. And it would be something more like a four-sided dice,
yeah.
Like a D4 in modern gaming terms.
I don't know for sure, but I would have to guess that would mean it's the biological shape would mean it's not quite perfectly random which number you get. Like there is actually a bias towards some of the faces of the die since it's not, you know, perfectly machined to be equal.
That's a good point.
But I don't know that. That just seems likely to me. One of the really interesting things about Synod is how this game held sacred connotations for the ancient Egyptians. Like, it doesn't seem to be a coincidence that Nefertari is shown playing the game in a painting within her own tomb. The pharaoh Tutankhamun was also buried with Synod game boxes among his grave goods to be taken into the next life. And we mentioned earlier that the name of the game means passing. It's the game of passing. And this probably has significance on the board itself because it's believed that you played the game by sort of advancing past your opponent along the squares, and you could, like, pass your opponent, you could block your opponent. So it is in some ways literally a game of passing in terms of its mechanics. But Synod also seems to hold this strong religious significance associated with death, which for the ancient Egyptians meant passing on into the afterlife through this cosmic journey. I know, Robert, you've talked about that on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before, you know, the beliefs about the journey of the dead among the ancient Egyptians where you'd adventure through the netherworld.
Yeah, it's not just a matter of you're going off to something we would think of as sort of a modern paradise.
Yeah, there's like trials.
There are trials and, you know, continued adventures and adversaries in the Egyptian afterlife. And that's one of the reasons that the departed has to bring all this stuff with them.
Yeah.
Like some of it, they're bringing things they like, uh-huh. but they're also bringing things they will need.
Exactly. And so it may serve some purpose to, like, I mean, I'm thinking about passing time in the afterlife. There are all these, I don't know if this is just a curious feature of English in how these ironies are stacking up. But so this is a game which, like, the idea of a game in ancient India often meant, you know, they literally meant time passing, like the passing of time in a mm-hmm. game. So games are for, in a way, passing time. The mechanics of the game involve passing players as the game of passing. And the meaning of the game spiritually has to do with passing into immortality.
Huh, interesting. Boy, there's probably a lot you could do with just looking at how different board games interpret linear and cyclical time.
Yeah.
Or both to some extent, you know, of taking our existence and piecing them out into step by step.
Well, yeah. I mean, so if this game in some way is presented as a model of something that these people believed actually happened to them, we still have games like that today. I mean, we were talking earlier about the game of life. I mean, the game of life in many ways you could think of as a kind of like normative model formation engine for like, this is what a life looks like. You, mm-hmm. you know, go to college, you get a job and you start a family. And the game of life kind of enforces that by having you go through these motions over and over again. It's all there in the fluff, like all the normative things that are being suggested about what life should be like. Perhaps Senate is the same way. I mean, when thinking about the religious details of the game, I started to wonder about if some part of the purpose of the game was not necessarily to have the negative connotations of this word, but propagandistic, to spread particular ideas through a catchy and inherently fun medium. It wouldn't be the only game that did this, right? We just mentioned the game of life, but think about Monopoly. Even though it's one of the most popular board games in modern history, Monopoly has its roots like thoroughly in pushing a particular point of view. Specifically, it was created in the early 1900s by a writer, inventor, and progressive activist named Lizzie Magie, or Maggie, M-A-G-I-E. And Magie invented it specifically to illustrate the dangers and evils of monopolies, of wealth accumulation, and of these like rent-seeking barons that you become in the game.
Yeah, it's ironic because Monopoly has, in a very simple way, it kind of glorifies this idea of the mustachioed rich man, right?
That's the funny thing. Yeah. It originally wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to do the opposite. The original title of her game was The Landlord's Game. Mm-hmm. And Magie summed up her goal to a reporter in 1906 by saying, quote, "In a short time, I hope a very short time, men and women will discover that they are poor because Carnegie and Rockefeller maybe have more than they know what to do with."
Yeah, again, that is directly the opposite of the message, if you want to say, that modern Monopoly has. It's directly the opposite of the message of Monopoly.
Well, I think it would depend on how you frame it. But yeah, I mean, people don't tend to take that away, do they?
Well, what's the Monopoly guy's name? He has a name, right?
He's Mr. Moneybags, right?
Mr. Moneybags looks too cute and adorable. Like he needs to he needs to have more of this gnarled Ebenezer Scrooge-like vibe to him, you know?
Wearing like a necklace of bones and all that.
Yeah, it needs to be less it needs to be less cute. It needs to be grotesque in some fashion, like the real ultra rich are.
Well, they had to make the game friendly to children. That's where they went wrong. But a funny thing also about the game is that she was apparently interested in using it to promote Georgian economics, the set of ideas stemming from the economist Henry George. Did you know about this, Robert?
No, I did not.
Yeah, so basically George suggested that people should not be taxed. I think this is the basic form. People shouldn't be taxed on the income from the work they do, but instead should be taxed so that the spoils of land ownership and subsequently like natural resources and rent and everything are distributed equally among everyone. So you can't make money just by owning land or by owning a mine or something like that. Instead, you can only make money on the work you do.
All right. But Monopoly is a game in which that's what you do. You just acquire things and just money comes in because you own them.
So you're playing as the bad guy in Monopoly. But again, you start thinking about it backwards. But anyway, of course, the game became wildly popular, especially in these derivative forms for which other game designers apparently claimed credit. But it didn't necessarily teach the players, as we're saying, all the things that Magie hoped it would. And so this is something else to consider that it's widely agreed, as we were saying earlier, that the rules of games change over time. You know, games don't stay fixed, they evolve. And I want to pair that with the fact that you don't often have to put much effort at all into a task to make it feel like a game. Just framing it as a game can be effective in making it feel fun and like a game. And this has been demonstrated by empirical research. You know, the whole Tom Sawyer painting the fence trick. You know, this is a great game where you paint the fence and everybody wants to get in on it. Apparently, there is some research that shows this is true. I was looking at a study from 2015 in the journal Games and Culture by Andreas Liberoth that is called Shallow Gamification, Testing Psychological Effects of Framing an Activity as a Game. And it found, you know, you don't really have to do much work to make something into a game. You just sort of call it a game and basically frame it as a game and people will enjoy it as if it is a game. So anyway, my crazy series of thoughts here is I wonder if games, maybe like Senet as an example, could be created to teach or model or advocate a particular view of the world, a political view of the world, a religious view of the world, creating some kind of normative model of how people should see things or how people should behave or act, but later end up spreading and remaining popular simply because the game mechanics are fun, and then the fluff loses meaning or gets shed or gets changed over time, sort of like happened with Monopoly.
Yeah. This would be a discussion for another time, but like you do wonder, what does a particular country or region's popular game forms, what does that say about them?
Yeah.
Like what does Monopoly say about the U.S.? And I think it's unfair to have that be our game. But,
right.
But what does Monopoly's popularity say about the United States? What does, say, Settlers of Catan and other like German and European design games, what do they say about mainland Europe? What does the popularity of Warhammer 40,000 say about the United Kingdom?
Is that where it comes from?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And again, these are perhaps this would be an attempt to read too much into a game's popularity. But at the same time, I do agree that I think there is some sort of influence taking place. Like to engage in a game, to engage in a system of a game's rules, you're really putting your head in it. You're putting you're taking your thought process and forcing it to mimic the systematic layout of the game.
Yes, but as we're seeing, it seems like if the game is fun, it's possible that the layout of the game, you know, the thing that maybe even it was intended to teach or put you in the frame of mind of, that can all be lost, can all be changed. It's possible that Sinnet is something that's created for a kind of normative cultural purpose in ancient Egypt. It serves to teach something about their religion and their society and all that. But because it's a fun game, it spreads to other societies for which these meanings don't really carry over.
Right. So they're just stuck with the mechanics.
Yeah.
And that's what they can continues to live on.
I mean, another way of thinking about this could be that original forms of chess were, you know, what were they for? Perhaps they were for trying to like teach a military mindset to young knights or something like that. But that's not necessarily what they're for now. It just turns out that the mechanics of the game are too fun to be contained and they survive their original cultural context or meaning. So now we're going to be talking about the Royal Game of Ur, another ancient game from thousands of years ago. Last time we talked about the Egyptian board game Sinnet. This is a somewhat similar game, though it's different. Sinnet was a game of 30 squares that were lined up in three rows of 10 squares, and you somehow advanced along the squares and tried to pass your opponent. Ur is somewhat different, but it's also a game of squares, right?
Yeah, it's basically two square grids connected by this little bridge. So you have a 3x2 grid, and then you have a 3x4 grid, and then you have a two square horizontal bridge connecting the two. And we said the name of this is the game of Ur. And I believe if anyone who's listened to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you might remember that we've in the past mentioned the great ziggurat of Ur. Well, it's the same Ur. It's in what is now southern Iraq. To be clear, evidence of the game of Ur dates it to the same time period as the Great Pyramid of Giza. We're talking 2500 BCE. We've also seen 2600 BCE as a date for the game of Ur.
Okay, so almost as ancient as Sinnet.
Yeah, pretty old. Now, this is another one where we're not exactly sure how the game was played with this curious board, but different scholars have weighed in to suggest how the pieces moved or might have moved and how they might have even battled in the narrow channel between the smaller and greater grids. Game historian Andrea Becker believes that the origins of the game might have been a form of divination.
Oh, okay. So that again.
Yeah, with specific boards related to specific sorts of divination. What's more, she argues that they might have also served as a way to teach divination. So that's interesting. So instead of teaching, some sort of economic model, it's about teaching someone how to divine the future.
Huh. Well, so now I'm seeing three ways that you can have a relationship between ancient board games and divination methods. So you could have one route that's just derivative, right? You've got divination methods where, say, you throw knuckle bones to get an answer from the gods, and then you also realize that that can be used to determine outcomes in an abstract scenario, which is like a game. So it's just derivative of divination. Another route or connection here would be that it's used to teach divination. A third would be that it is a form of divination, that the board game itself is a method of consulting the gods.
Yeah. I mean, it gets into the whole situation. Like, is any battle game, is it a battle? Is it a simulation of a battle? Is it preparing you to simulate or take place in a battle?
Yeah. Is it a derivative from battle principles? Is it designed to teach you battle, or is it actually a form of battle that's supposed to decide something?
Exactly. Now, one of the cool things about Ur is that eventually we did get some codified writings about how it is played. Not so clear, apparently, that there's not a lot of continued discussion about exactly how it was played.
And, of course, how it was played probably changed over time.
Right. But many centuries after its introduction, you did have a clay tablet from 177 BCE that weighed in on how to play it. Mm-hmm. And it's a rare exception to the lost to history nature of board game designers because if accounts are true, and, of course, we have to sort of apply a grain of salt when we're talking about individuals described as doing things in ancient texts. But
yeah.
The rules for this game were codified by the Babylonian scholar and scribe Iti Marduk Balatu in 177 BCE. And he even added new features, which Brian Fagan in his book said, quote, "enliven it for the contemporary gambler." So I'm assuming that means play mechanics and not mere fluff.
But there is a lot of interesting fluff to this game, actually. And the fluff, I would say, seems to coincide with the idea that the game was used for divination-related purposes, maybe to teach divination or maybe actually as a form of divination associated with astrology, right?
That's right. So a man by the name of Irving Finkel with the British Museum, I believe, he translated the cuneiform and believed that while there were strong astrological aspects to Ur, he believed it was still primarily a game. So that the astrology was fluff as opposed to its primary purpose in society.
But the fluff is really interesting. Like, I looked up some of this writing and translation work by Irving Finkel on the cuneiform of the original board. And so what the evidence shows is that the squares of the board were often labeled in a way that caused the game board to produce prediction statements as you played it. This is from Irving Finkel. And so you'd have these ways that the game board could produce sort of a sentence, but it would also be associated with an astrological sign. So so you could have the game board say, "one who sits in a tavern," or "I will pour out the dregs for you," or "you will find a friend."
Oh, well, that's nice.
Or "you will stand in exalted places," or "you will be powerful like a lion," or "you will go up the path." There are a bunch of interesting ones, like "one who weighs up silver." I love these. They make the game feel very creepy and elemental.
Or the one that says, "you will cut meat."
"You will cut meat." That's a great one.
What does that mean? Does that mean, is it good meat? Like, I will have a feast in my honor and I will be the one to cut it? Or is it more like, I will work at the butcher shop?
I don't know. "You will cut meat." Apparently, it's associated with the astrological sign of Aquarius. There are other similarities like that. Like, "you will be powerful like a lion" is associated with the sign of Leo.
Now, this gets really interesting because, you know, we can think about ourselves. We can think of modern humans. And for us, divination practices can be fun. Again, going back to the idea of the something like a fortune cookie at an American Chinese restaurant or
Magic 8 Ball. Or you know what's actually also at the intersection of a game and a divination practice is, you remember the game MASH that that kids would play in elementary school and stuff?
Are you talking about with the folding paper?
Yeah, it was – well, I think it was
the
related to that.
The four-way mouth?
MASH, I think, stands for mansion, apartment, shack, house.
Uh-huh.
And so it would be a thing where you'd have a number of options for different things that could come out of it. So you'd be like, "who will you marry?" And then you'd give like four options and then – you'd use some kind of pseudo-random procedure to generate a number that would like have you go through the list counting a certain number of places to like rule out answers until you got to the end. And the end would give you some combination of possible answers. So it'd be like, "you will live in a mansion and you'll be married to Tim Curry," and et cetera.
Huh, interesting. So yeah, there's the fun side to divination, but even today people get taken in by divination and it can be a very stressful, a very serious situation.
Oh yeah.
That you can, you know, people can lose a lot of money investing in divination. But then likewise, gaming is much the same. Games can be a lot of fun, but if you you're playing the wrong game, you're playing with the wrong people, or you're playing with the wrong attitude, games can be a seriously unpleasant experience.
Yeah. Okay, we just got a MASH update from Tari outside the booth here. Apparently, Tari was a big MASH fan, and she says one important part we left out is that you've got to add bad options in your MASH list. So it's like, I guess, the shack in MASH. You also, like, if you have potential husbands you'll marry, one of them has got to be a really, like, lame, ugly guy, so that you'll end up with funny combinations, she says. So maybe you're living in a mansion, but you're married to Pee Wee Herman.
You know, this reminds me a little bit of a card game that I've really enjoyed playing recently called Gloom.
Okay.
And it uses these transparent cards that actually have a mechanical purpose in the game. But essentially, you have these cards that indicate different members of your sort of Edward Gorey style family. Mm-hmm. And then you want to have the most miserable family that dies in horror.
Oh, you told me about this.
And
yes.
So what you try to do is to make sure your family has the most horrible experience possible and dies off. Meanwhile, bestowing happy things upon the other. So you want your family members to, say, catch some awful plague and drown in a well. But then you want members of the opposing families to, say, frolic with a kitten or something like that.
Uh-huh. So MASH is complex. It's got to include both possible outcomes, right? It's part gloom and it's part mirror, mirror on the wall. It's like part giving you all the stuff you want to hear. And then also it's got to throw in some bad news to make it real.
All right. Well, let's bring it back to Ur here.
So, okay.
There's at least one theory that Ur eventually evolved into backgammon. So again, we see this time and time again with these old games, like looking at the possible lines that connected them. And then also kind of like species, like actual organisms, you see examples where one game was kind of killed off by another. You had like an invasive game come in from another culture, and everyone's like, whoa, why are we playing this when we could be playing that? And then a game dies. But another interesting thing that Finkel brought up is that it likely used what were known as astragals, and these would have been those four-sided dice made from the knuckle bones of sheep or goats. Again, it's so fascinating to think of many modern board and dice games as the tail end of something that began in perhaps divination maps and rattled animal bones, you know? In this sense, all games are potentially occult exercises. By the way, Finkel apparently has a couple of books about ancient board games that feature rules and punch out boards and spinners.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Younger players especially can try out at least versions of what some of these ancient games could have consisted of.
Well, you got to wonder, like, what are the best games lost to history? We know that there must have been lots of games that we don't even really know anything about, or maybe only have a hint of. We don't know all the rules. That could be the most fun game ever. They could be so addictive, and we just don't know what they are, because there's, of course, an endless possible combination of rules you can come up with for moving pieces around on a board. Maybe there's, like, the ultimate perfect game out there, and it's totally unknown.
What if they basically had Space Hulk in Babylonian times? Because again, coming back to what I said, there's no reason you couldn't have a game with the exact same mechanics as Space Hulk take place in an ancient setting.
But I thought what was a major part of the appeal of Space Hulk was the fluff. Like, you like the illustrations and the setting and all that, right?
Well, I do, but Space Hulk also has this wonderful mechanic where you have two forces. You have the humans who are superpowered and tough, but then you have the Horde. And the Horde, so the timing is different. So when the humans go, when the human player goes, they have a time limit. They have a certain amount of time in which they have to make all their moves and use all of their movement points. Mm. But the player controlling the alien hordes of the gene stealers, they have all the time they need. Mm. So I do feel like there is something primal and attractive in the mechanics of Space Hulk that captures this feeling of you know, it's like it's so grimdark. It's the most grimdark game because it's like I am up against death. I am up against this thing that is ever patient and everlasting and is probably in the game. I mean, it's probably going to kill you. It's a very dangerous game to play. And part of the fun is not in, oh, did I win, but did I almost win?
Now, if I understand the Warhammer universe correctly, it would also be the implication that the humans are not really good, right?
No, the humans are awful, but they're the best choice compared to all of the other awful things in the universe.
All right.
Which does feel kind of like appropriately like ancient, that it could have – that mechanics like this could have found their way in, say, a Babylonian mindset.
Well, I like that.
All right, let's take one more break. When we come back, we're going to just roll through a few more examples of ancient board games and board games of note, and then we're going to close out.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back.
Now, one of the ancient games that that seemed kind of interesting to me is a game of, if I understand correctly, it's basically of unknown mechanics known as Liu Bo, which is an ancient Chinese board game.
Right. The name means six sticks. It's the game of six sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Liu Bo sounds a lot better. It rolls off the tongue
right.
a lot easier. So the rules of this game, yeah, are still uncertain. But we see figurines of men playing it from Han Dynasty tombs. That would have been the area of 2002 BCE to 220 CE.
Mm-hmm.
And it was likely invented in the first millennium BCE. But the height of its popularity was definitely the Han Dynasty. So there would have been two players, there was a board, and sticks were thrown to determine the movement of pieces. And one of the reasons we don't know a lot about this game is this game died out because there was an invasive. There was another game that was a competitor.
Huh.
The game of Go entered the picture in the Zhou Dynasty, around somewhere in the region of 1046 through 256 BCE, and eventually just overtook Liu Bo to become the most important board game in Chinese culture, and it remains so to this day. Now we didn't. You know, we're talking about casting the sticks here. One thing we didn't even really get into this into it all in this was the long dice. You see these referenced in some of the Hindu epics talking about casting the long dice in battle. You know,
now, what is that?
Well, they're just they were a type of dice that were long and more stick like.
Huh.
But they were used as a form of generating a random figure. Now, speaking of India, we do have to at least touch on chess really quickly. Again, chess, a much later game than anything else we've discussed here, first millennium CE, came out of India, and it still commands a global following today, and even though it's not as ancient as these other games, it's still pretty old, and it's really impressive that chess remains such a standard of strategic board games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it is, I mean, it is kind of the gold standard.
I mean, I think it's one of those games that doesn't really need much fluff because its mechanics are so solid, right?
Yeah.
That it is there is such a thing. I mean, I think, again, we should acknowledge we've sort of been hinting at this, that it's pretty clear that some games are just inherently better than others mechanically. I mean, there's such a thing as a much more balanced game that's that does better at allowing different types of strategy and thus makes it more interesting because there are more different ways you can achieve a win. There are other games that are I think just sort of easier to hack.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing that makes for a bad game, a game that's easy to hack.
Yeah, or can you break the game easily?
Or a game that requires no skill at all, of course. But
right.
Among games that require a skill, if there's a way to hack it so that if you just know a certain strategy, you can pretty much always win, that game becomes less interesting. Tic-tac-toe is a good example of that. I mean,
right.
If you know how to play and you go first, you can always either win or be forced to a draw.
Right. I think another similar example is Apples to Apples.
Yeah.
Which can be a fun game. I'm not anti-apples to apples. But if one person does not want to play, if one person wants to break the game, they will break it.
Oh, that's breaking in the opposite way. Yeah. Breaking by like not having a strategy that just always wins, but breaking by ruining it for everybody.
Right.
Though most games that involve any kind of like, I don't know, intelligent input or verbal input by the player, I feel like can be like that. It seems to me, I don't have as much experience with D&D as you do, but it seems to me Dungeons & Dragons is clearly a game where one bad player can completely ruin the game.
Well, yeah, there's such a social context with Dungeons & Dragons. I was talking to this with one of the gamers I play with recently about the idea of competitive Dungeons & Dragons,
mm-hmm.
and how there have been some efforts to create sort of the, I wouldn't necessarily say a limited rule set, but certainly a system in which you could have competitive game playing
mm-hmm.
Between characters. And then you could also, I guess, there are some of the older, like really fierce dungeons that can be used as a competitive environment. But for the most part, you're not going to see games of Dungeons & Dragons on, say, ESPN 6 or whatever. But you will see games of Magic the Gathering on there because Magic the Gathering is more of a traditional game. It is a traditional card game that has hard, fast rules and does not have this social role-playing element to it. Another example, and this is one we have a whole episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about, but Werewolf.
Oh, yeah.
Is a highly social game. And certainly if you were playing Werewolf with people that were not on board with it, And I don't even like to imagine people of that caliber. But if he were trying to play a game with people who are not into it, it would wreck the game. You just wouldn't be able to play werewolf.
Absolutely. One obnoxious player will ruin the experience.
Now, I mentioned earlier, what happens when an invasive game comes in and it's better than what you have.
Uh-huh.
One example of that is the Viking game Tablet. This is one of the Norse Tafel games from the 4th through 12th centuries,
mm-hmm.
probably based on the earlier Roman game Ludus Latrunculorumus. And it was replaced by chess in the 12th century. So basically they found chess and they're like, whoa, this is way better than this thing. Let's just switch to chess. And they did.
Now, that makes it interesting also because that suggests that certain games occupy certain almost like ecological niches within culture if they can be displaced like that. Because one game obviously does not displace all other games.
Right.
You know, a new game doesn't come in and say, now this is the only game people play and all other games are gone. It can beat out certain games. And it makes it suggest that there's an ecosystem of play and that certain games fill certain roles within that. And that if another game comes in and fills that particular role better, then that game will win out. But you wouldn't see chess replacing foot racing, you know?
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's a certain place in your culture, in your life, maybe even daily or weekly life, that this game can occupy. And if something fits that role better, then it's going to take over.
It also suggests that there are different kinds of fun, mm-hmm. and that certain games elicit one particular type of fun but not another one. So they'll be in competition for that limited fun resource that people have to give. As one consequence of thinking like this, I've sometimes wondered how much overlap is there between the demand for board games and the demand for video games? Will video games ever completely replace board games?
Well, it's been interesting to sort of watch this play out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because today we have so many amazing video games. The graphics, the complexity, the different types of video games. And at the same time, look at the board game renaissance that we're living in. We're just living in a golden age of you can go out and you can find so many different types of competitive games, strategic games, cooperative games,
mm-hmm.
games that mix competition and cooperation, games with a million different varieties of fluff to them, games for old people, young people, different levels of rule complexity, games that certainly have some basis in video game design. Like there's certain communication between the two worlds for sure, but there's just so much out there. Like clearly board games fulfill something in our lives that a video game cannot quite handle.
Yeah. One clear example is that board games have some kind of social element that's I don't want to say more mainstream because that's not necessarily it, but the social element that's more acceptable among certain kinds of social settings than video games do. Like I can see there are people who would be into going over to a friend's house for a board game night,
mm-hmm.
but who would not be going over to a friend's house for a video game night.
Well, right. Yeah, I remember going over to people's places and they were playing Rock Band.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a game where you work together. You play it together with other people. But where's everybody looking? They're looking at the screen.
Yeah.
It was kind of a sad sight. But you go over and you play a board game together and you're facing each other.
Yeah.
You end up
hating each other.
Well, yeah, depending on the game, right? But you have this interface between you. It's this thing that's bringing you together. And certainly video games can be very social. There are some wonderful online communities built up around these.
Mm-hmm.
But the board game it facilitates a more of a physical in-person connection. You know, it is people who would otherwise not gather around a table and have anything to talk about can gather around the right game and they're good to go.
After all this discussion, I'm kind of interested in coming back to the question we started with. I don't know if we've answered this, but to think a little bit more about, now that we've looked at these games, what is the role these games are playing in the biological impulse toward play? Again, we know that we haven't fully answered the question of why play exists among animals like us, but there are all these theories that maybe it signals reproductive fitness, that maybe it helps teach us skills we need later in life, maybe it helps make us more versatile, things like that. Where do board games fit into these theories, if anywhere?
Indeed. I hope this is a question that people will take with them as they go on to inevitably play board games with their friends, with family, with coworkers, with strangers, however you want to do it. And certainly if you weren't planning to play a board game, maybe consider picking one up or pulling one out of the closet. As we begin to close out here, we always want to thank Scott Benjamin for helping us out with the research on these episodes. Scott brought a number of cool board game facts and lists to our attention, including a couple of world records that are interesting to look at in light of everything we've discussed.
Uh-huh.
So one of them is the largest collection of board games. As of 2011, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, it was one Jeff Bosby's in the United States with 1,531 different board games.
You know, that's too many board games.
It does sound like
I'm
a
sorry.
Lot.
I don't know. I don't want to be judgmental, but like, can you really play all those?
Well, it sounds doable. It's not improbable. And then the longest marathon playing a board game, this was from 2017, 80 hours achieved by four participants in the Netherlands. And this was from January 3rd through the 6th of 2017. They played a total of 400 games of Ganzenbord, Game of the Goose, during the 80-hour marathon.
That sounds like too many games of Ganzenbord.
Yeah, I mean, you could have fit like three games of Arkham Horror there instead. So,
sorry, I'm getting all finger waggy.
I love
go home, guys.
I kid Arkham Horror. I love Arkham Horror, but I've also never completed a game of Arkham Horror. So anyway, just a couple of Guinness World Records to help close out these two episodes on games.
I just had one more thought about thinking about the role of board games among the biological category of play.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a way of approaching the question of what role they serve or what the real essence is to think about what makes a board game not fun. Like that might help us come in on it. So one thing that's definitely not fun is when board games are too easy to win, right?
Right.
When there's no skill involved. Like, I mean, I guess little kids enjoy playing Candyland, but just general like roll the dice and move your pieces and have no skill involved, that's not fun.
Yeah, not for grown and advanced players. Likewise, one frustration I've had with certain games, and I won't name them, is when I've played a game where there were too many ways to win. Like it was, I like having a certain amount of complexity. Like it's neat when you have like a doom counter and, you know, there are several different things going on at once. But there was at least one game I played and it was like there were five different ways to win it. And I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be doing, like how I was supposed to employ strategy. I just felt kind of lost in the system. And I felt like it needed to be somewhat simplified, at least for a first play.
I know exactly what you mean. At a game night here in the office, we played a game that was some kind of like zombie outbreak setting type game. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of it before, but it had so many rules. The rule book was like a novel, and there were just so many different things you could do or had to do each turn. And we played this game for like multiple hours, and we had never figured out how to play by the time we stopped.
Right.
And that is frustrating. That's like, that's not fun. Maybe some people have fun doing that, but I don't, and I think a lot of players don't. So there's also a part of us that desires a game to be concise. Like there's a certain kind of elegance in games that have a small list of rules from which great complexity of gameplay emerges.
Right. I also like it when a game organically, gradually increases the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a game I really like called Fabled Fruit,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically a card game, very kid friendly, and but the cards change as you progress. So when they start off, it's very simple. You're trying to collect different fruits to make different essentially smoothies,
mm-hmm.
and each smoothie is a point. But you quickly move through the initial cards, and you get in the more you play the game, the more complex the mechanics of the cards becomes. But you're going to work up to that. Like you just work up to that point by virtue of playing the game. And I think that's just a rather clever mechanic. Even if you may never even get to the later cards, you know, I certainly haven't playing it with my son, but he loves playing it at the level we're at. And it's comforting knowing that we could keep playing it and it would just get more complicated, but he would be able to roll with it via the experience of playing with it at lower levels.
I love that. Yeah, the games with a what do you call it, a slow learning curve or whatever, the games that are easy to pick up and difficult to master, that seems like the sweet spot of what a game should be if it's really great. Like, that, you know, that there is a lot of skill and strategy involved if you know what you're doing, but also it's not impossible to just get going and understand how the game works.
All right, well, we're going to close it off there, but obviously you've all played board games or card games and various other games that fall under this loose category. And we would love to hear from you about them. What are your favorites? What are your least favorites? Hey, have any of you played some variation on the ancient games that we've discussed here? The proposed rule systems are out there. You can find proposed rules for and Senet online. So if you've done that, let us know what you thought of them. What was it like to sit down and play some variation of this ancient leisure activity?
Did it make you feel like a pharaoh?
Maybe so. As always, you can find the other episodes of Invention at inventionpod.com. You'll find links to our social media accounts there. If you want to discuss the show and discuss your favorite board games, and you're on Facebook, head on over to the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. That's where listeners discuss our other show, Stuff to Blow Your Mind, but also episodes of Invention. It's a good place to interact with other listeners and also with the two of us.
Thanks to our friend Scott Benjamin for research assistance on this episode, and to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.